Now for some announcements. This weekend is the second anniversary of the U.S. invasion of Iraq. At the moment, there's a rally going on in Concord, New Hampshire, and if you have missed it, you also have a chance to go to a gathering tomorrow, Sunday, March 20th, at 2 p.m. in Market Square, Portsmouth. The gathering will be a place where people can resist how they see fit, whether it be vigil, play music, make art, or drum, etc. Sponsored by the New Hampshire Anti-Fascists and Seacoast Peace Response. For more information, you can email amyla44@juno.com. On Tuesday, March 22nd, at 12:30 in the afternoon, and postponed from March 1st, Speaker Frieda Berrigan will be presenting Women and War at UNH Durham in the Wildcat Den on the first floor of the MUB. Marking Women's History Month, Frieda will talk about women's experience in war, not in a historical perspective, but right now. What are the experiences of U.S. servicewomen in Iraq? What are the experiences of Iraqi women under occupation? What are the experiences of women in the U.S. under the Bush administration's global war on terror? And what steps can we as women take against war? Sponsored by the UNH Peace and Justice League. For more info, contact EWOLFF@CISUNIX.UNH.EDU. Also on Tuesday, March 22nd, postponed from March 1st, 7 p.m. that evening, Frieda Berrigan will be in Portsmouth at the UU Church, 292 State Street. Her talk will be Stop the Merchants of Death, War Profiteering in Iraq. We will look at companies profiting from war and occupation in Iraq and discuss the impact on Americans in terms of dollars, policy, and security. By learning more about the companies that profit from war, we can identify some weaknesses in the Bush administration's rhetoric and some chinks in the armor, opportunities for action. Sponsored by Seacoast Peace Response and the War Resisters League, for more information, you can call 750-7506 or email amyla44@juno.com. Wednesday, March 23rd, from 4 to 5:30, Dr. Gino Strata, renowned war surgeon, writer, and filmmaker from Milan, Italy, will be speaking at UNH in MUB Theater 1 on his experiences in war-torn countries and to discuss his book entitled Green Parrots, A War Surgeon's Diary. For more information, call 862-2398 or visit the website www.unh.edu/CIE. Later on, Wednesday, March 23rd, 7 p.m., the continuing multimedia series, Creating a Peaceful World, The Challenge of Oil, on the demise of oil supplies, government policy, and solutions for sustaining our communities and the earth. This is happening at Dover Friends Meeting House, 141 Central Ave in Dover, New Hampshire, and is sponsored by the Dover Friends Meeting, Seacoast Peace Response, the Seacoast Alliance for Democracy. Tonight's topic will be the oil factor, which is a video examining the link between oil interests, the current U.S. military interventions, and the war on terror. For more info, contact 603-431-8644 or pkabell@rcn.com. Next Saturday, March 26, at Clark University in Worcester, Mass., there will be a conference on globalization, privatization, and water. For information on this, go to www.massglobalaction.org.
Once again, we hear the word precision from people who think bombs can be precise. We hear the price of fighting terrorism from people who don't have to pay that price. We see a cloud where there should be a college. We see a reservoir reduced to soil. And though they now admit that the marketplace was hit, they didn't hit the Ministry of Oil. What they call a military target is sacred to all soldiers brave and loyal. You can bomb a shrine, you can bomb a power line, but you never bomb the Ministry of Oil. Once again, the mayhem they call warfare is followed by the melee they call peace. Tearing through the stores and the museum, while the U.S. Army played police. How much do you suppose that artwork sold for? As their last remaining food began to spoil. The situation's bad, but no place in Baghdad is safer than the Ministry of Oil. The medicine has all been confiscated, and soon there won't be water left to boil. And one might wonder who'd think up names like oil for food, when what they mean is Ministry of Oil. If there's any logic in the universe, if the future isn't just absurd, if justice is precise instead of infinite, if freedom is enjoyed and not endured, I'll take my class out someday on a field trip, past the shells of Shell and Uniroyal. And as they're roaming round the musty White House grounds, I'll say, kids, this was the Ministry of Oil. I'll say, kids, it was a peaceful revolution. There weren't any battles to embroil. And I'm very glad to tell that not one person fell. It's an aspect of our history that every child knows. building being destroyed, but at least it was the Ministry of Oil.
That was The Ministry of Oil by the Prince Mishkins. While there are quite a few costs for maintaining America's military empire, the costs of the war in Iraq over the past 2 years, since the war began on March 19, 2003, include 1,175 American military casualties. Also, the official estimate of American wounded is over 11,300. Other coalition troops that have been killed are at least 171. Civilian casualties killed by military intervention in Iraq are between 17,000 and 19,400, officially at least. However, a report published in October 2004 in The Lancet stated that the casualties were far higher. Public health experts from the USA and Iraq estimate that around 100,000 Iraqi civilians died as a result of the March 2003 invasion, the majority being violent deaths among women and children relating to military activity. Results of the research, done among clusters of Iraqi households last month, was published online by The Lancet on Friday, October 29, 2004. Dr. Roberts comments in that document, quote, "Making conservative assumptions, we think that about 100,000 excess deaths or more have happened since the 2003 invasion of Iraq. Violence accounted for most of the excess deaths, and airstrikes from coalition forces accounted for most violent deaths. We have shown that the collection of public health information is possible even during periods of extreme violence. Our results need further verification and should lead to changes to reduce non-combatant deaths from airstrikes." As of 2:16 p.m., March 18, 2005, the war in Iraq cost the United States $156,905,322,567. Instead, we could have hired 2,719,195 additional public school teachers for 1 year, or we could have paid for 20,782,224 children to attend a year of Head Start, or we could have insured 93,955,597 children for 1 year, health insurance that is, or we could have provided 7,606,452 students with four-year scholarships at public universities. Or we could have built 1,412,790 additional housing units. The war in Iraq cost New Hampshire alone $716,554,059, and Maine $466,897,778. Basically, some would call that quite a bit of money.
This is Amy Antonucci with Making Waves. Today, on the anniversary of the invasion of Iraq, we are also going to speak with someone about the occupation of Palestine. We have on the phone Bobby Luton, coordinator for the Rhode Island Cachalia Alliance. Bobby lives in Providence, Rhode Island. She spoke in Portsmouth in September 2003 on the topic of Do Fences Make Good Neighbors? About the security fence or wall going up between Israel and Palestine, and her travels in the area. Welcome, Bobby. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Amy.
Could you start by talking some about these two different occupations, Iraq and Palestine, and what you see as similarities and connections between them?
Well, I think for the people in Palestine and Iraq, they're experiencing a very similar occupation, and they see their struggles as very much connected. I think that although the occupation of Palestine has been going on for quite a few decades and the occupation of Iraq is recent, they both are part of a strategy that has been part of the U.S. game plan for the Middle East and also Israel's game plan for quite a long time. And we're seeing Bush really speed up that agenda. And I think that's about having regime changes wherever there's a regime that's not complying with the U.S.-Israeli agenda. So there are some regimes, which some of them are very repressive and brutal, but which are propped up by the U.S., and they're just fine because they know who's the boss. They listen to their master. The occupation of Iraq has benefited Israel a lot. I think Saddam's big crime in the eyes of the American administration was his independence. It wasn't his human rights record. He was not a problem when he was violating lots of people's human rights, but he became a problem when he really became independent of the U.S., and that also meant that he was willing to significantly threaten Israel, both in his stance and potentially militarily. So it benefits Israel a lot to have Iraq under the U.S.'s control, and also for the U.S. and for Israel to open up markets to basically have access to the resources that they want anywhere in the Middle East, and to have the markets, and to have basically compliance from all regimes. So I think that the struggle of the people, the resistance in Iraq, has learned a lot from the resistance in Palestine, having watched it for many years. And I think also the resistance in Iraq is an inspiration to Palestinians. Iraqis were also beaten down for quite a long time through U.S. sanctions. And Palestinians, obviously, have been squeezed more and more over the years. So they're both resisting under extremely difficult circumstances with very limited resources. And the Iraqis have been able to stand up to the, you know, the biggest guy on the block, and that's an inspiration. And I think that both of those peoples, as well as others in the Middle East, see their fight as a fight against U.S. imperialism in whatever form it takes. And Israel is playing the role of a proxy state, kind of another American state which isn't bound by the Constitution and which has unlimited military resources from the U.S.
We'd love to hear more about the group that you're involved in specifically, the Rhode Island Qalqilya Alliance.
Sure. We started the Rhode Island Qalqilya Alliance a couple years ago. It was started by a group of activists in Providence who felt like we really wanted to try to get past the activist community and get ordinary people who don't see themselves as political or who don't see themselves as activists to understand their connection with Palestine. So the goals of the organization, we've tried to create a grassroots alliance between people in Rhode Island and people in Qalqilya. Qalqilya is an area in the West Bank. It's kind of like a state. It has a governor and a big town named Qalqilya, and then a number of smaller villages. So it's a little bit like Rhode Island in that sense. So we've been trying to create natural connections, trying to help people find what they already understand, what they're already good at, for example, if they're in the medical field or if they're an artist or a teacher, and help them to connect with Palestinians who have those same interests or skills so that they have a natural way to start exploring the issue. And the goals are for people to have a chance to really learn about the situation directly. People have been misinformed for so many years. They've been bombarded by media, which is pro-Israel. So it's hard, even if they are willing to hear what we have to say, it's hard to change your opinion overnight when you've heard something different your whole life. So we want to create the opportunity for people to really find out for themselves by interacting with Palestinians what's really happening there. And we also want to find ways to significantly support the Palestinian community. So that's one of our goals, is to raise funds for schools and do different kinds of projects which give material support and also just support in terms of solidarity and friendship.
And you yourself have visited Qalqilya?
Yeah, I went last year and the year before. The first time I went was to meet people there and talk about starting this project and see how interested people were. Then I went again last year, and we're planning a trip again this summer.
What's the situation there? I understand that in particularly one community, Jayus, there are a lot of problems right now because of the building of the security or separation wall.
Yeah, the Qalqilya district is very severely affected by the wall. The town of Qalqilya, if you look at a map, is completely circled by the wall or the fence, with just one entrance, which is a military installation. And that's a city of about 40,000 people. So, you know, the villages all around Qalqilya used to rely on Qalqilya for the hospitals and schools and so on, and now they're cut off. Jayus is a little village of about a little over 3,000 people, which is near Qalqilya. Because Qalqilya is along the Green Line, which is the border of the land that Israel took in 1948, and then to the east of that, the occupied West Bank. So Qalqilya lost about 80% of its land in 1948 when it was seized for the State of Israel. So it's been a progressive situation of having lost land then. The village of Jayus also had land taken for the State of Israel in 1948, and there's several members of the Israeli government living on land that was seized from Jayus families. And then there's been a progression. Once the areas became occupied in 1967, then Israel started moving settlers in right on top of the villages, taking land belonging to families. So there's been a progressive loss of resources. And then since Oslo in 93, Israel has started building this infrastructure of Jewish-only roads, which work very much like the wall does in that they cut up Palestinian communities. Palestinians can't cross the roads, so they're like walls. And taking the water resources since 67, Palestinians have been limited to the same amount of water, and Israel's taking, I think, 80-some percent of the water from that rich aquifer in that area, so it's very desirable for Israel. The land and the resources are, but not the people, of course. So then what's happened in the village of Jayus, this settlement was built about 15 years ago, taking a lot of the village, and then the wall was built about 2 years ago, and that comes in about 4 miles, again, east of the Green Line, so carving a large amount of Jayus up behind the wall. So since that time, farmers have been struggling to get to their land. Israel tells the world, no, you know, this is just for security. We're going to let people go and reach their farms. But in reality, that's very often not the case. Many, many people are denied access to cross over to their land. So then in this last December, bulldozers showed up and they started plowing up land behind the wall. You know, this is what the farmers had been saying ever since the wall started, that Israel's really confiscating this land for settlements. So they've been in a legal battle since December, and we've launched a campaign with them. We've been trying to work with our congressmen and senators, who all say they feel bad about the situation, but they can't do anything. The State Department says they feel bad about the situation, but it's the Congress and senators who are the only ones who can do anything. So that's the current struggle they're in, and it's really a situation of a very, very good agricultural area, which has provided not only for themselves, but also for much of Palestine, because they're on such a rich aquifer, and they've lived that way for hundreds and hundreds of years, and they're really going through an ethnic cleansing process. Already more than half of the village are in exile. You know, if the settlement is built, which will be built in a long strip, again, creating another kind of a wall, very soon Jayus will be reduced to kind of like a refugee camp that's depending on UN rations, and then the forecast is that the settlement will build factories and industries there, and that the people of Jayus, who were once farmers who were providing well for the area, will now be reduced to landless refugees who will then be forced to work in Israeli factories.
What is the wall that you're talking about? Why is it being built? What is its stated purpose?
Israel has said that it needs to build this wall for security reasons, to prevent suicide bombers from coming into Israel. But I think that that Israel has actually been talking about building the wall for quite a long time before that. In some places, it's a wall. It's very, very horrifying to see. It's 25 feet high, which I think is twice the height of the Berlin Wall was. And in towns like Qalqilya, there's a whole side of the town where you have this 25-foot-high concrete wall. When you walk up to it, there's like a sloping base, and the base is higher than you. It's just horrifying. And then there are sniper towers every, a couple hundred meters along the wall. So this horrible concrete structure has a lot of impact in terms of the crops that grow in the shadow of the wall can't even grow anymore. Of course, the wall itself has destroyed a lot of agricultural land. In other places, it's not a concrete wall. It's a fence, but it actually has destroyed more land where it's a fence because it has a wider footprint. There's a series of barbed wire and rolled wire, and then there's like a foot tracking area, and then there's a road for military vehicles, and then there's the main fence, and then there's the same thing on the other side. So it's destroyed a lot of land. The most obvious thing about the wall is that it doesn't go along the Green Line, which Israel wanted to build it for security. It logically should have built it on Israeli land within the borders that Israel considers to be Israel at the moment. I don't think Israel has ever been willing to declare borders, but the other side of the Green Line, in other words. But it hasn't. It's built the wall inside the Green Line and not even near the Green Line, but snaking deep inside the Green Line in many, many places. So when you look at the map, what you see is that Israel really built the wall to separate Palestinians from illegal Jewish settlements in the West Bank. So the only way it's really separating Palestinians from Israelis is it's separating Palestinians from the Israelis who were already illegally settled in the West Bank. But it's still not really separating Palestinians and Israelis because the structures were already in place for that. The settlements are already very highly guarded. There's, you know, Jewish-only access roads and all kinds of things like that. So the main impact of the wall is really separating Palestinians from Palestinians. So you have villages which are behind the wall, and people there have to wait for a soldier to open the gate for their child to go to school and come home. You have villages which may have been just a stone's throw away, and now it would be like a several-hour trip to go down and find a way, either go around where the wall snakes in or find some kind of a gate and wait for the time that it would be open. So what's happening is that this is separating people from medical facilities, it's separating people from schools, it's tearing up families, even before the walls. I think the West Bank is a little bit bigger than Rhode Island, and there's 700 barriers that Israel's created for transportation. So already people, you know, before the wall was built, people were saying, well, I haven't seen my grandmother in so many years, or when I got married, my family couldn't come, even though they lived just 30 miles away or something. The wall has just intensified this. People can't get their produce to markets. Now Israel's talking about building some tunnels and bridges to create access points. And what it looks like is that the ultimate goal is to create this Palestinian state, which is really a series of small little dots which will be connected by bridges or roads, which will be so easy to control. It's like one of those hamster cages where you have the tunnels and you could slide something down and say, okay, you know, no movement here today, and we're going to remove this part for a while. So that before, the occupation required a large amount of force and presence from the Israeli military, and in the future there will be so much infrastructure doing what soldiers had to do that will only take a few dozen people with keys in the right places to really lock down the entire population. It's really a very elaborate prison that's been created. And if the Palestinian Authority can be talked into it, then those keys can be transferred into their hands and they'll lock down their own people, which will put even fewer Israeli soldiers' lives at risk.
What do you say to people who maintain that Israel does need to do this for its security and that Israel has been the target of violence, and what else can they do?
Well, I really think that the whole issue of security, I grew up in South Africa, and I really, you know, I was raised during a time when I was a teenager, the resistance groups in South Africa at one point decided that they were going to kill 10 children from the schools in my area and so on. And so I look at this, I think, from the point of view of an Israeli. I can identify with Israelis in that sense. And my point of view is that I'm not sure that people have a right to security when they're completely destroying security on every level for other people. And not only that, but they're totally dispossessing them and oppressing them. So I don't think Israel will ever be secure until it gives up Jewish supremacy, which is its motive for oppressing Palestinians within Israel and for trying to take more Palestinian land and basically for disregarding Palestinians. So I think that what Israel has done is Israel keeps increasing the stakes. I think that the Palestinian people will demand their freedom and they will never stop doing that, and ultimately they'll get that. And so it's a matter of sort of saying, like, look, you know, I'm going to have my rights. And the other party ignores you, and so you start speaking louder and louder until you're screaming. So Israel uses more and more extreme measures to silence them. So I think what Israel's doing, every time it ups the stakes for security, what it's really doing is it's escalating the situation. I mean, I'm sure that Israelis feel that suicide bombings are very horrible, but possibly more horrible things could happen in the future if the stakes are raised. There are a lot of ways that people resist in societies which have been completely removed from the equation for Palestinians. So every time Israel closes doors for resistance, I think that less desirable options from an Israeli point of view are necessary. I think that security is totally within Israel's control. If it gave up Jewish supremacy tomorrow, I think all the violence would stop. That's what drives it. I've never picked up any kind of anti-Jewish, you know, anti-Semitic sort of vibes from Palestinians. It's all about, this is our land, we have a right to live here as equals. So Zionism, which drives the whole Israeli mentality, is about using having been treated as inferior people in the past as a justification to now be superior and have rights over native people. And that equation is never going to work. There's never going to be security, and I really don't think that there's really reason to try to claim a right to security under those circumstances. It's like a rapist trying to claim the right to protection. You know, they can't stop what they're doing until they're guaranteed that they won't be harmed in any way, and then they might consider stopping. That's really the equation. So I should also mention at this point that our organization, Rhode Island Colonial Alliance, has very little politics. We have really one politic, which is that we understand Zionism to be the cause of the conflict in Palestine. So when we speak, like I'm speaking right now, I'm really speaking from my own views. We have quite a range of views within our organization.
something that you said I found particularly interesting, that in your travels you experienced no sentiments of anti-Semitism amongst Palestinian people, which also I know a number of people who have traveled in Palestine who are Jewish and spoke about that themselves, that they felt completely welcomed, and when it was clear their purpose for being there, they did not have any problems, which I think I found surprising and a lot of people would find surprising. And it sounds like that was your experience as well.
Yes, I think it's quite remarkable because for a Palestinian, a Jewish person isn't this abstract concept. Every single person that you run into who's humiliating you, the whole occupation structure, every single person you deal with in that structure is Jewish. Every conversation I've ever had, people have made a real distinction between Jews and Israel, between Jews and Zionism, and they blame Zionist agenda for what's happening to them, and they completely distinguish that from Jews. There have been a lot of Jewish people in solidarity who've been there, and that's probably helped as well. I know when I went and stayed in one village, the family I stayed with had me sleep there next to their kids and carrying their kids around all the time. And a couple of days later, they said, "Are you Jewish or Christian?" And I said, "Christian." And they said, "Are you Catholic or Protestant?" And so, they didn't know what I was, and it obviously wasn't an issue, and that is what I've experienced. I think another thing is that what I've heard from many Palestinians is, they know about the Holocaust, they understand the history, and the response is always, it's really terrible what happened to Jewish people in Europe, but we didn't do that to them, and it doesn't justify them doing the same kinds of things to us. And so there's an acknowledgement of Jewish suffering, but a firm stand that, we're not going to be the scapegoat for what Europeans did to Jews. One thing that you notice when you're in Palestine is, and I think it's a Middle Eastern quality in general, is that people have a very strong world consciousness and political interest, so that people tend to be very much more informed about history and world events, I think, than Americans do. So you might go to a village and think, well, maybe some people there don't know about the Holocaust or, South Africa or something. And, you talk to an 80-year-old granny and she knows about all these things because that's what people do. They sit around and eat cucumbers and drink tea and talk politics all the time.
What is the difference between Zionism and Judaism?
I don't think there's really any overlap between Zionism and Judaism. Zionism came out of Europe when the whole system of segregating Jews into ghettos and so on was starting to collapse, and Jews were beginning to integrate in society. There was some tension at that point with Judaism because the situation of being ghettoized did protect the Jewish community from a religious point of view. So there was some difficulty at that point where there was reaction from the religious part of the community saying, if people just assimilate into German society, they're going to lose their faith. And other people saying, no, that's what we have to do, we just have to fit in. So it was Jews who were secular and of this assimilation kind of point of view who then at some point, there was a case called the Dreyfus case, you could look it up and see the details, where one of the Zionist thinkers, before Zionism really got founded, came to the conclusion that basically Europeans were inherently racist towards Jews and there was nothing that you could do about it. Even if you were very well assimilated, sooner or later anti-Semitism would crop up again. And so the only solution was separatism and for Jews to go and form their own state. So it was a nationalist movement which actually had a lot of resemblance to Nazi nationalism and collaborated with Nazi nationalism later about basically this kind of purity and we can't live together. So they supported each other's objectives. The Jewish religious community really opposed Zionism from the beginning, including, I think, the chief rabbi, I don't remember exactly what the title is, of Jerusalem. So Jews who lived in Palestine, Palestinian Jews, opposed Zionism, and the Jewish community throughout the world was not supportive of it until much later. And this was all, of course, long before the Holocaust. And then Zionists collaborated in the Holocaust with the Nazis at various times. Then also, committed acts of terror against Jews in Arab countries to try to force immigration to Israel. And at some point, the project gained momentum. And at this point in time, it seems that the vast majority of the Jewish community has come to feel an obligation to support Israel. A very central piece of Israel's propaganda is trying to equate the Jewish people with Zionism and with the State of Israel, which is really a ridiculous and a horrible thing, for one thing, to try to equate an entire people with a particular ideology and political program is, to me, pretty racist to say that it's somehow inherently, you know, every Jew would inherently embrace Zionism, and that's not the case. There are many Jews who are still opposing Zionism. There are Orthodox Jews in New York whose main focus is to fight Zionism. They travel around opposing Zionism wherever they can. They went to Arafat, to visit Arafat when he was dying. They just went to the refugee camp where Sharon committed massacres in 82 in Lebanon. They visited there last month, I think. And their opposition to Israel is on religious grounds, firstly, saying that that's incompatible with Judaism, and secondly, because of the impact it has on Palestinians, of course. And many of the Israelis who have been Zionist leaders have been secular, so it's certainly not driven by religious goals, although it's very useful to try to drum that up. It's useful not only to drum up kind of religious sentiment about returning after all these years to the land of Abraham, but that's very effective with Christian Zionists, who seem to be quickly growing important force in the Zionist movement. Christian Zionists feel that Jews have to return to Israel before Jesus comes back. So they're putting a lot of support and resources and political power into supporting Israel pretty much unconditionally.
How has your experience growing up in South Africa during the apartheid years affected your work on this subject?
Well, that's really what took me to Palestine in the first place, but in a very roundabout way, because I was really infatuated with Israel as a child. I even took some Hebrew lessons, and I thought one day maybe I would go live there and try to be an Israeli. I really knew nothing about Palestinians. But later, as a teenager, I became really focused on what was happening in South Africa, and I wanted to become a teacher and use education as a place, or use the school as a place to deal with, you know, apartheid was starting to come down at that point, and we were anticipating having these classrooms with different races and backgrounds and languages and everything, and in South Africa there really wasn't a focus on education beyond the academic content, so I was really interested in using that as a way to engage the issues. So when I was in college and I needed to do research, I thought, well, you know, where could I find models for this kind of thing, multicultural education and dealing with conflict and reconciliation? And I thought, well, Israel, of course, they have people coming from all over the world, and, you know, they must have a lot of these kinds of things to deal with. And so as I started to read, I really came across Palestinian thought and experience for the first time, and it really changed my viewpoint. And over the next year, you know, I met a lot of Palestinians on campus and started to learn about what their lives were like. But when I went to Palestine, I went in 92, and I traveled around Israel and visited some groups working on reconciliation. And a lot of that opened my eyes not only to what was happening in Palestine and Israel, but also to what had happened in South Africa. There were a lot of reconciliation, especially in the church, in Christian circles, where you would have these kind of kumbaya evenings where black youth and white youth would get together and put their arms around each other and go home at the end of the evening. And I feel like in some ways there may have been some good experiences in that, but ultimately it may have been quite destructive, because it's trying to accomplish reconciliation without acknowledging injustice and addressing it. And so the person on the oppressing end, like myself, goes home thinking, well, I know black people who like me. I must not be responsible. I must not be, you know, guilty. And maybe the black person goes home thinking, oh, these are supposed to be my brothers and sisters in Christ, and I'm supposed to not feel anger and hostility towards them. I'm supposed to accept this. And I saw that sort of approach, I think, in some of the Israeli programs, where there wasn't a real acknowledgement of injustice and an attempt to address it, and dealing with reconciliation in terms of oppressors and oppressed people, but more like kind of an emotional, you know, let's all like each other kind of approach. So it changed my view a lot. I think at that point maybe apartheid as practiced by Israel was not advanced as apartheid in South Africa, but I think since then Israel has far exceeded what apartheid ever did. Israel certainly worked with South Africa on developing models. So for me, you know, I grew up as a white privileged child. I didn't ever connect with the struggle as a teenager in a real way, and I didn't have a whole lot of political consciousness. So in some ways I feel that it's a duty of South Africans, and maybe especially white South Africans, to help the Palestinian struggle. It's the same struggle, and I feel that the struggles are connected for me.
What is the U.S. involvement in the Israeli and Palestinian struggle?
The U.S. has had an involvement right from the beginning, and going back for a second to kind of Middle East games, I mean, the way that the Zionist movement in Europe, you know, before Israel was conceived, marketed itself was to go to European powers and say, look, you know, you're basically losing your ability to maintain your colonial empires, but you still want control of the Middle East. So we're European. If you give us Palestine, we will defend European interests. We think like you. You know, we'll be a bastion of sort of European thought in the Middle East, and that will really help you. And that was very appealing, but at that point, some of those European powers were really losing their dominance, and America was gaining dominance. And so that equation has really benefited the U.S., and I think that's really Israel's role for the U.S. and why Israel gets incredible support from the U.S. So right at the beginning, America really forced a partition plan in 1947 of Palestine, and the U.N. voted against it, and one by one the U.S. went to different members and forced their vote. I think in some cases they went to countries and said, we'll pull out all our investment in your country unless you change your vote. In others, there was a promise of, you know, railroads or whatever. This isn't going to happen unless you change your vote. And so one by one votes were changed, and this partition plan was voted for, which gave most of Palestine, a little over half, to the Jews, who were then, I can't remember, maybe like 12% or something. Or maybe they had they owned about 12% of the land at that point, and they had brought in enough immigrants that they were 33% of the population, and Palestinians got the rest. And neither Palestinians nor the Zionists were happy with that, because the Zionists wanted all of Palestine, and the Palestinians wanted all of Palestine, it being theirs. And then Israel started a war of independence and conquered 78% of Palestine, so that partition plan never went into effect. But that was the U.S.'s commitment right from back in 1947, and it's increased funding ever since then. The U.S. gives, on the books, there's clearly $4 billion a year, but very likely about $10 billion a year to Israel. The Israelis are 1/1000th of the world population, and they get 1/3 of our aid. And in some cases where we give foreign aid, there's these big offices with maybe more than 100 people working to make sure the money is spent according to our principles. In the case of Israel, there's no such thing. We don't hold them accountable. And while we've been fighting about this case with J.U.S. Land, we've been talking to the State Department and saying, why don't you hold them to account? We are doing this. This is Rhode Island tax money that is paying for the destruction of J.U.S. And they said, well, we don't have those kind of conversations with Israel about what they do and why. So there's a very deep and unconditional commitment. The U.S. obviously gives Israel almost total cover, political cover. In the U.N., there are many, many, many resolutions that have come up against what Israel is doing, and very often it's the U.S. or the U.S., Israel, and a couple little islands that block the resolutions. So the U.S. has pretty much single-handedly protected Israel from international law for many, many years, completely funded the occupation and the Israeli ability to be so brutal. And the thing is that Americans often don't know this, and yet little kids in Palestine know this. You'll see a little four-year-old, and they know that Israel's the problem, but America's the real problem, because Israel couldn't do this without America. Because they'll be on their tricycles, and they'll pick up a tear gas canister saying, made in the U.S. You know, and they'll see Caterpillar bulldozers and Apache helicopters, and it's really an American occupation with Israeli soldiers.
How can people get involved if they're interested in learning more and acting in some way?
Well, what we're trying to do here is, I mean, when I look at really how the situation is going to be resolved, I think the U.S. has a deep commitment to what it's doing. So what we really need to do is undermine that commitment. We need to pressure our representatives and start to build a force where we make it very clear that we won't put up with this, that for one thing, we know what's going on in Palestine, that our media is not going to tell us, but we have other sources, and so we are no longer oblivious as to what the U.S. is doing there. And then I think that for justice to happen in Palestine, a lot is going to have to be reversed that has happened, but in the meantime, there's an intensive ethnic cleansing program going on. When you're there, what you feel at every turn is intense fear and insecurity. The way that the whole occupation is set up is with incredible, I think, unpredictability is probably like the key psychological strategy, so that you never know what's going to happen. You never know how a soldier is going to react. You never know when you're going to run into a military roadblock or something like that. And there's humiliation. There's incredible fear. And what all of that does is it creates a climate which is so intolerable that it's a psychological ethnic cleansing strategy where basically life becomes so unbearable that you leave if you can. The Palestinians recognize that, and so people have really made a choice that no matter what you do, you're going to have to kill us to make us leave. We will not leave because life is so miserable here. We will not leave because, you know, my wife died at a checkpoint because you wouldn't let her get through to deliver a baby. We will not leave, bottom line. So I think that our role is to support people in that. So one thing that we're doing is trying to help the communities hold on to their land and their resources. We're raising legal fees right now for the farmers to be able to fight to maintain their land in Jayus. We also have a project with schools where we're getting even kids in Rhode Island to sponsor kids in Palestine, not as a charity thing where like, oh, we're helping these poor people, but recognizing that our taxes are the ones that are what is destroying these communities, and so we have a responsibility to help them financially and materially as well to maintain their hold. So to maintain their grip on what's left is important, and for us to find meaningful ways to do that, I think, both through using our political power, such as it is, and our resources. I think the other thing is to support the Palestinian resistance. The U.S. certainly could end what's happening, but I don't think it will. And I think that the Palestinian resistance is still the strongest force in actually winning freedom for people. Europe certainly could put an end to this, but they won't. In South Africa, the resistance was in a similar position. They did begin to get support from the international community in the form of sanctions and boycotts. I think that's really powerful. I think that divestment campaigns are very important, and also things like athletic and academic boycotts. I think that the experience of living in Israel or in South Africa is that all of those people don't even really exist. You know, you have a life like in America, and it's only when there's something violent or horrible that happens that it intrudes on your sunny Saturday afternoon. So I think that the Palestinian resistance, which gets condemned a lot for invading in horrible ways on a sunny Saturday afternoon for Israelis, I think that they're the only ones really forcing Israelis to even think about what they're doing. So I think that the bottom line is creating cost. I don't think the Israelis are going to change their mind. Knowing the psychology of white South Africans who felt that they were good Christians and that, you know, they didn't hate black people, they wanted the best for everyone, but they were not going to give up their privilege until it became too costly to hold on to. And so we have a lot of things we can do to create cost for Israel, for the U.S. government, so that it gets to a point where it's not worthwhile anymore to do this. Palestinians have very few things which they can do to create cost. A huge amount of their resistance is nonviolence, and I think nonviolence is effective in terms of holding on. When you're there, you just see almost every moment acts of resistance, which are just things that mothers and grandmothers and kids are doing to hold on to their dignity, to hold on to their psychological health, to hold on to their land and their families. But those things aren't hurting Israel. And so the things that Palestinians have, which are actually costly to Israelis, are pretty gruesome kinds of things. But I think, again, that that's Israel's choice. Israel could stop that any time. And in a way, I see that Israel is making the choice. When an Israeli child gets killed in a suicide bombing, they get a color front page picture in the U.S. media. You know, look out how inhuman these Palestinians are. I think that Palestinians know very well the value of the life of a child. And they're saying, what is it going to take until it's not worth it to you to do this to us? You take the lives of our children. You speak to us in the language of our children's blood. What is it going to take for you to understand that you can't do that? We will not give up demanding that you can't do this. Is it going to take your children's lives until it's not worth it to you to take our children's lives? And I think so far the Israeli response is, yes, it is actually worth some of our children's lives to keep doing this, because it would be very easy for them to stop. They would have to give up their grand vision of Jewish supremacy in Palestine, but it would save their children's lives, and that's not a trade-off they're willing to make yet. So somehow the cost has got to be increased. We can condemn the way that the Palestinians increase the cost if we want, but I think it's much more important for us to look at ways that we can increase the cost. And we're actually co-aggressors with Israel right now, so I don't think it's very useful to condemn what Palestinians are doing to try to reverse what's happening. I think we really need to find ways to be effective.
So part of what you're saying is that we in the United States, who are such a huge part of this violent occupation and who have many nonviolent methods for speaking out against the occupation, have the responsibility to do that.
Yeah, I think education is useful because we still are at a point where most Americans really don't know what's going on. I don't think that education changes American behavior. I think there's a lot of things that Americans have lots of access to information on and they still don't change their behavior. So I think that's one component, is education. But then we really need to build stronger and stronger movements which up the pressure on the government. So I think that we need to base education and action in a real commitment against racism, against apartheid, against the form that those take as Zionism, and really, deal with every person as an equal person, and deal with the native people of Palestine in terms of their historical rights. Not let Israel start the clock all over again all the time, and talk about people having rights wherever they are, even if they stole the land that they're on from people who are now living in a refugee camp somewhere else. So we do have a lot that we can do in terms of building divestment and boycott campaigns and building stronger ties with the Palestinian community. Israel has really isolated the Palestinian community from the world, so I think it's important to establish those direct ties. And part of our project, too, is trying to create a way for Palestinians to speak to us that's uncensored, where we have our own media, in a sense. So one of the things we've been doing is create email groups, and some of the people in Qalqilya just set up a PAL talk group where you can actually just talk to each other, on your computer without typing. And, we start to build relationships where we start trusting each other more and sharing our views more openly and being able to ask each other more difficult questions. And that's an opportunity that most Americans don't get. And it's an ongoing thing where you don't just think about Palestine once a year when you go to a talk, but you're actually communicating with people on a daily basis, and it starts to shift your understanding. So I think there's useful things like that can be done. Really working for an understanding that the international community has abandoned Palestine, that they're not applying international law in the case of Israel, and that we reject that as Americans.
Lastly, what is your website?
It's www.riqa.info, I-N-F-O, and there's contact information on there if you want to email us. We're just getting the website going, so there's more to come, but you will find details about the campaign we're doing on J-Use and some background on Qalqilya and our project.
Great. Well, thank you, Bobby. This was Bobby Lauten from the Rhode Island Qalqilya Alliance, and we're so glad to have had you with us today.
Thank you, Amy.
Fire raining from the sky, who will be the ones to die? The old, the young, the quick, the lame. When fire falls, we're all the same. There has to be a better way to lead us to a brighter day. For when the bombs have had their say, what price will we have paid?
What price?
I sit here in my privilege, lamenting loss of innocence. Things that once seemed so secure, no longer making any sense. There has to be a better way to lead us to a brighter day. For when the bombs have had their say, what price will we have paid?
What price?
If I call you enemy, will your dying set me free? A stranger once did that for me. Must we shame his victory? There has to be a better way to lead us to a brighter day. For when the bombs have had their say, what price will we have paid?
What price?
Fire raining from the sky, revenge will be mine, the sirens cry. Truth the victim one more time, will we ever draw the line? Still I dream we'll find a way, I'll meet you on that joyful day. When peace will reign this time I pray, that in the garden we will stay.
That was There Has to Be a Better Way by Graham and Barbara Dean. Thanks for joining us today on Making Waves. The Making Waves crew is Amy Antonucci, Steve Diamond, Brian Gregg, Tom Jackson, Stanley Longstaff, Dino Pappas, Joanne Paradise, and Jeff White. We welcome and need your participation too. Please email us at nhmakingwaves@yahoo.com to let us know what you think of our show and if you'd like to work with us. You can live stream our show on Saturdays 2 to 4 if you are not in range of the station by going to www.wirenh.com/radio. You can also listen to all of our past shows on our complete online archive, indexed at www.freewebs.com/sprav/audio.htm. Thanks to radioforall.net, our new host, you can now download higher fidelity files in stereo. Tune in with us next Saturday from 2 to 4. We'll be exploring women and work, women and war, and hearing from feminist activists at UNH. We leave you now with this quote by Emma Goldman in 1917. All wars are wars among thieves who are too cowardly to fight and who therefore induce the young manhood of the whole world to do the fighting for them.